ॐ भद्रं करने तिष्ठन्याम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षतेर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सुष्ठुवागुंसश्चनूभिः यशेम देवहि संयतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति न भूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः We're on. I'm going to go over first in Edward's book, verse 9. I think we did that some last week, but I'm going to touch on this again, verse 9. And it's the one that starts with Sarvabhutastam Atmanam.
Page 121.
121 in the big book. Okay, and then we'll go right into 13, but I want to do a little review of this. Verse 9, which is verse 12 in my book. Sarva bhutastam atmanam, sarva bhutastam atmanam, sarva bhutani chatmani, sarva bhutani chatmani, sampashyan brahma paramam, sampashyan brahma paramam, yatinanyena hetuna, yatinanyena hetuna. So, Sarvabhutastam.
Page
130.
Yes, 130. Oh, 130. Sarvabhutastam Atmanam Sarvabhutani Cha Atmani Sampashyan Brahma Paramam Yati Na Anyena Hetuna. I want to spend a little bit of time on this so that we can go into the meaning of the word Om, which is going to be covered in the next verse. This particular verse is really going into the Satya Mithya, kind of understand what we call, Satya means that which is real, that which is true. Mithya is everything that depends for its being on the real. Like, for instance, the snake is Mithya. Just a little review for some people who might not know this. The snake is Mithya. The rope is Satya within this empirical reality. The rope is what is real. The snake has no being without the rope. If I pull the rope up, the snake is gone. So that's what we say, it is mithya. It has a dependent reality. We could say that in the clay pot example, the clay is Satya. That is what is actually there. The pot is mithya. There is no pot, independent pot, apart from the clay. So the Satya-mithya relationship has got to be thoroughly understood to understand what we say Advaita non-duality. Non-duality means one without a second. There are not two, there's only one thing here. But there are many things here. So how to resolve duality into non-duality, or how to resolve duality, see that the reality of duality is non-dual. That's what we have to see. But to see that, you have to be able to see that this duality, which means everything that exists within the time-space creation, like this room, for instance, is an infinite manifestation of duality. Duality means more than one, is two, subject-object. You know, there's two things here. Non-dual means there's only one thing here. There's no way of dividing it into two things. Let me just explain that, just go run through that really quickly for a minute, what we actually mean by non-dual. Some people could say that this universe, for instance, is non-dual. If I were to say, for instance, the word non-dual is used in a lot of different ways, non-dual because there's only one universe. Like say if I say the word for Jagat, the word for the creation, the Jagat, everything that exists within time and space is just one infinite manifestation. It's one. Everything is contained in it. It's only one. So that, we could say, that's what we mean by non-dual. Everything within it is totally interrelated. There's only one thing there. You know? So because, and this is a common definition of non-dual also, to say that everything is interconnected, so there's really only one thing there. Everything's interconnected with everything else. So that's not at all what we mean by non-dual. We would accept there's one universe that has many parts. One infinite manifestation. This creation is an infinite manifestation of knowledge, or infinite manifestation of duality. You can say it's all one infinite interconnected manifestation, this creation. But it's infinitely interconnected, an infinite plethora of parts. Like there's so many parts here, so there's this one thing that has many parts. So since it has many parts, it's not non-dual. For it to be one, it would have to be one thing that has no parts. That would be non-dual. One thing with no parts. And so we look at three different types of duality, and when we say the one, when we say the word non-dual, each one of these three types of duality have to be negated. First type, well, it doesn't really matter the order that we go in, but the first one that I'll mention is called Vijatiya Bheda. Bheda means duality. Vijatiya means there are duality between species or between sets. Like cats are different than dogs or different than rocks. So in this creation, we can divide the whole creation probably into an infinite number of sets, an infinite number of like things, and each set is different from another set. But because one set is different from another set, you know, that is dual, right? So that's obvious. We'd say, oh yeah, there's many, many different groups of things in the creation. And that's one of the ways that the creation is dual. For us to say something is non-dual, there can't be many sets. There can only be one set. There can only be one set. But now say we've got rid of, say, let's just say we're now searching for the non-dual. We're going to get rid of all sets except for one. Say we have the cat set. We'll keep that one set. Okay. Now, the problem with sets is that sets have many parts. Right? And so that's the problem. We have one set. But in the set are, you know, 5 billion cats. So, not non-dual. So what we need for non-dual now is to get rid of all the sets except for one. And now that we have the one set, we have to say, okay, it's one set, but this one set has only one member. Now we're getting closer. Okay. So now we have one set, just to imagine the non-dual, we have one set that has one member. So the set of cats now, there's only one cat in the set of cats. But now the problem is we have one set, one member, but that member has many parts. The cat has its little paws and whiskers, etc. Okay? And so the cat itself is not non-dual. So you need one set, which has one member, which has no parts, okay? In order for something to be non-dual. And so now when you look at this universe, you can say that if we define the universe as everything that exists within time and space on every level, we can say there is only the one Ishwara, one manifestation, right? But say if we're only looking at this manifestation, this Maya manifestation, we'd say, all right, that is one set, there's not two sets. And that set has only one part. We're just looking at Ishwara. It would say that all there is Ishwara. There's one set, and it only has one member. But that one member has an infinite number of parts. And so actually, even though it's totally interconnected, there's an infinite manifestation of duality. You see what I mean? And so we have to go from the infinite manifestation of duality, which is dual in every way and at every turn. We have to go from that infinite manifestation of duality to the non-dual. which is one set, one member, no parts, one without a second. And any way you look at it, one without a second. To do that, we have to be able to differentiate between what we call satyam nitya. That's the only way, actually. We have to be able to see that everything that we experience in this creation has only one being. It only has one being. Kind of like if you look at the ocean that has a countless number of waves, and all of those waves are wonderfully interconnected, and they all make one ocean universe of interconnected waves, right? They're called dual, right? The ocean with all of the interconnected waves, that's dual. We have to be able to recognize the one water. And you can, right? If we use the water drishtanta, the water example, and I said there's many waves but only one water. All of the waves are part of the ocean, but all that's really there is one water. You know, and you can see. It's a good example. It's a very good example. We use the bass relief example also. If you have a large block of clay, and an artist carves an intricate scene. So it could be a city street, you know, with city buildings, people walking along the street, and animals and carts, and all kinds of things can be carved into this bas relief clay, you know, chunk of clay. And if I were to say to you, all that is really there is clay, you say, yeah, right? But you're coming from a perspective outside of the clay. That's the problem. That's why it's so easy for you. Like if you look at the ocean and I say, oh, that's really there is water. Oh, yes. So waves are nothing but water. Yes. It's not that there's waves and water. It's there's only water. And there's waves also, but the waves are totally dependent on the water for their being. Oh, yeah. No problem. It's no problem, right? It's obvious. The same with the bas relief. You see all of those characters as though walking down the street, and all of the bullock carts and all of the, you know, all of the buildings and all of that. I see all of that, I can imagine all of that coming to life. In fact, it's so well done, it's so well crafted. But do you see that the only thing there is clay? Oh yes, of course. Do you see that all of those characters, those caricatures and all those buildings, right? Even though they are there and they have their usefulness in our imagination anyway, they're very useful, really, they depend for their being totally 100% on the clay. If I were to pull the clay away, they would have no existence at all. That is clear for you, right? Because you're outside of the clay. You're not built of clay. But if you were one of the characters in You were one of the characters in the bas relief, or if you were one of the waves looking around at the other waves, you know, that is totally different. Totally different scenario then. Because you're experiencing the names and forms from within the manifestation of names and forms. A name and form is experiencing a name and form through sense organs, which are names and forms. You see what I mean? So everything that allows you and I in this universe, we're part and parcel of this universe. Right? We're not outside of the universe. You know, there's not some Archimedean point outside here looking and, oh, look what's happening, you know. We don't have that. And so we are products within this universe. Products in the sense we're part of an interconnected whole. And we all happen to have, you know, sense of mind and sense organs, which are all also made out of this dual universe, made out of the same names and forms, the same manifestation. And so we, being within the box, so to speak, are able to experience other names and forms within the box of the universe, right? But it's very difficult. It takes a lot of teaching for us to recognize that every part of you that is an experiencer, all of your sense organs in your mind, for instance, that are experiencing all these names and forms, mm-hmm. it's very hard for you to realize that everything, the subject, object, knower, known experiences that you're having, are mithya. That they are depending upon something else, right? They depend on something else for their being. They enjoy a truth which is in fact independent and free of them. You know, it's just like if all of the waves, they imagine in the ocean, it becomes a very, very quiet day. But there are no waves. If the waves just become totally flat. No waves at all, totally still. You are fine. Right? Absolutely nothing has happened to you. Because who are you? Are you the wave of the water? Who are you really? There is no wave. If we take the two, wave and water, there is no wave. There is only water. You know, and so if the wave becomes flat, what happens to you? Well, nothing, because nothing's happened to the water. See what I mean? So that's the type of viveka that we have to have now. We have to be able to recognize here, in terms of this manifestation of duality that we're experiencing, which includes my body and my mind and my sense organs and my thoughts and my moods and my emotions. All these things exist within duality. We have to be able to differentiate the satyam from the mithya. We have to be able to differentiate the water from the wave. We have to differentiate now here as a human being sitting here, that which is not subject to coming and going, that which isn't a name and form, that which is the truth of all names and forms. So there's a viveka there that has to be done. And so here we're starting to work on that. And what he says here is he's going to work on this in two ways. The first half is this. Sarva bhutastam atmanam. That says the self that you are, it's not just some self, the conscious being that you are, sarva bhutastam, abides in all beings. The self, the Atma, you are the Atma. You're not talking about another Atma. You're yourself, the conscious being that you are. That conscious being abides in all beings. Sarva Bhuta means all beings. So yourself, your sense of me, doesn't just belong to this body, mind, sense organ. It is the very self of all beings. That's the first thing he says. So the self that you are is there, abides in sarva bhutas, all of the beings. Then it says, not only that, sarva bhutani cha, he says, and all of the beings, this room is enough, because there's more than one being here, so here we are all, and all of these bhutas, all of these beings, right, abide in me, right, in myself. So it says, atmani means in me, so I abide in all of these I. You know, you have to just experience yourself, because we're not talking remotely or abstractly. So when you say, I, me, and then you say, like I could say, I am Raja, or I am Carol, and there's Edward would say, I am Edward, you know, and we'll all say, I am. The I am that you're naming as this body, right? You're naming this I, you're naming as this. It is this I that you're naming as this body, this body-mind complex, this very I that you're correctly naming as the I, it is this very I that is abides in all beings. This very I that I'm now naming as Carol or Radha, it is this I that is abiding in you, in you, in you, in you, in you, in you. And not only that, because if I just say that, it could be like I'm like a little thread going through all of the beings. That's not the idea. It's that not only do I, does this I abide in all of you, but all of you are in me. That's, all of you are in me. If you think about it in terms of the wave ocean with the water, you could say, you know, the water is there in all of the beings. So there's some water going to this being, water going to this being, water going to this being. But now you have to see it differently also. You can say each being has some water in it, right? Because I'm abiding in each being. But now what you have to see is that not only that, that all of the beings together are abiding in me. If all of the beings together are abiding in me, there's no space, right? Between one being and another being and another being. It's not like they use the example that I like a thread am threading through all of the beings. It's not that. It's that I am the self of all of the beings, and all of the beings have their existence in me. That's the satya mitya. I am free, I abide in all of the beings, and all of the beings abide in me. So it's like the wave saying, you know, the water saying, I abide in all of the waves, and all of the waves abide in me. So there's no separation. Otherwise, the waves can have some different type of being, of which, the, you know, their own being, and the self goes through them. They have their own being, like a string of beads. They each have their own existence, and the string goes through each bead. Mm-hmm. It abides in every bead. Mm-hmm. But the beads are different, right? This isn't that. I abide in every being, and all of the beings exist in me. That's the satya mitya. So, and what it's saying is, there is nothing but me. There is nothing but me. I am the self of all beings, and all beings exist in me. So how to understand it really in terms of this room. How to understand it in terms of this room. I still think that the best way to understand it, and to over and over do meditations on this, is to understand it in terms of your imagination or in terms of the dream. If you understand it in terms of the imagination, it's like this. If I imagine a meadow and I'm in the meadow with friends. Imagine a meadow, I'm in the meadow with friends. In that situation, I, the one who has imagined the meadow, am abiding in every being. I am in the body that I imagined as myself. I'm in my friend's body. I'm in the whole group of people's body. I'm in the animal bodies. I'm in the bird bodies. I'm in the tree bodies. I'm abiding in every individual there. Because it's my imagination. Okay? So I am the self of each one of those. But not only that, the whole imagination and all of the beings are abiding in me. They have no separate existence apart from me. I am their very self. I am their truth. I am their satyam. I am satyam. The whole imagination is mitya. It has no being apart from me. I am the reality of it. It's just like the rope abides in the snake, and the snake is totally dependent on the rope for its being. There's the satyam and mitya. So now, if that is understood, and if you work with the dream example, because in the dream example, you're the Ishwara of the dream. You're the Lord of the dream. Right? The Atma is only one. Whether we're talking about Ishwara as the whole manifest creation, you know, or we're talking about, or the self of Ishwara, or the self of the individual, there's only one self. I'm talking here objectively. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being of Ishwara. Right? But you as an individual can only have limited knowledge. You can't have Ishwara's experience. Everybody get that? You can't have Ishwara's experience. You can't have an infinite manifestation of knowledge. It's not possible. You have a limited buddhi. But there's something similar. And what is similar is that there's only one self. It's not that Ishwara's got a bigger self than you are. There's only one non-dual self. So the self that illumines your buddhi is the self that illumines the entire creation. Okay. So, you are lucky enough as a jiva to have a little maya at your disposal. And the maya that you have at your disposal is what we call our imagination or our projections or dream. That's our little piece of maya, our little piece of magic. So, what you have available to you is Brahman, the self, the Atma, which is Brahman, with this little piece of maya that can imagine a universe. It can imagine a meadow. It can imagine a beautiful beach scene. It can imagine whatever you want it to imagine. You can put people in there. You can put animals in there. You can put birds in there. And so now, what that means is you have at your capacity the conscious being that you are with the ability to imagine a creation. And if you have that capacity, you can understand the satya mitya between the conscious being and the manifestation of duality. You experience it. You see what it is. You're the self of the whole, and the self of all of those beings is yourself alone. So you abide in every being, and the whole imagination abides in you. That's the reality that you get to experience on a limited level. Now, this infinite manifestation, it is the same satya mitya. Why it's harder for us to understand it is because we're part of the imagination. See, when you imagine the meadow, you're Ishwara. In reference to the meadow, you're the Ishwara of the meadow. You're the Lord of the meadow. You're not within the meadow. You don't have any problem with seeing the satya mitya. But here, in this manifestation, the jiva is within the manifestation. The jiva is within the creation. And you're the one that feels bound. You feel you're the one that has the problem. Ishwara doesn't have a problem. Just like if you imagine the meadow, you don't have a problem. Whatever's going on in the meadow is mitya. For you, you're Ishwara. Whatever's going on in the meadow is mitya. If the whole meadow collapses and goes away, it's okay. It's mitya. Nobody will be hurt. Nothing will happen. The whole meadow will explode. You can even say, okay, let's blow the whole thing up. If you don't mind, it's not a problem. But what if the creatures inside the imagination feel? They're thinking, oh my God, the whole meadow is starting to fall apart. You know? They have a huge problem because they are bound by ajnanam, by ignorance within the meadow. That's what we mean by maya. What is maya to Ishwara is ajnanam, is ignorance to the jiva. Causes ignorance for the jiva, the one who's within. So using the meadow example, just think, what type of knowledge does it take? Right? What does it take for that jiva within the meadow to recognize I am the meadow? And not only that I am the meadow and I am free of the meadow. That's what that jiva in the meadow, the one in the meadow, has to realize. That's natural for Ishwara. You're Ishwara of the meadow. You know, I'm the meadow and I'm free of the meadow. I'm the self of the meadow, I'm the truth of the meadow. The meadow is nothing but me. You know that. You don't even have to think about it. There's no ajnanam there. There's no ignorance there. It's a beautiful exercise to just imagine a meadow or an ocean scene or just any type of even a city scene. It doesn't make any difference. You know, and just hold that imagination and let it move and develop and recognize, just take note that the whole time that you're having this imagination, there is no ajnanam. you don't mistake yourself to be the imagination. You know, you don't become lost. You're the self of the imagination. It depends totally on you. You're its being. It is mitya. That's very clear. Because no ajnanam. That's Ishwara's situation. No ajnanam, no problem. But think of yourself within. Within the creation. What does it take for, what type of viveka, what type of clarity and analysis of the nature of creation does it take for you to actually have the aparokshajnanam, to actually differentiate, to know beyond any doubt, to recognize? It's not just knowing, it's recognition that your being, this me that you are, is the self of all beings. And that all of these beings, this whole room, is in me, and I am in all beings. That I am the changeless being, which is the self of this room, the self of all beings. That has to be, that's the knowledge that has to become clear for me. And so what he says is, the one who recognizes this Brahman, Brahman is that self, right? Recognizing that Paramam Brahman, or recognizing, seeing this, I say like this, seeing that myself is the self in all beings and all beings are in me, that person goes to Param Brahman, the Brahman, the self, which is Paramam, which is supreme, which is infinite. One sees this, and they use the word sampashan, means sees without doubt, sees very clearly. Sees means it's not some thought, it's a recognition. The one who sees this clearly, that person goes to Paramam Brahman, Brahman which is supreme. Goes to means what? Means this is what we talked last time, the ahankara shifts from its identity with its body, mind, sense organs. It shifts from that to the Atma, to the self. That's the travel. It's a non-travel travel. It's a non-going. Right? It's a travel based simply upon recognition. Instead of the self hooking onto the body, instead of the ahankar hooking onto the body, mind, sense organs, or the water, you know, the way of saying the water belongs to me, it's the ahankar now resolves into the Atma. And seeing that, one achieves Brahman, which is Paramam. Brahman is the Advaita. But Brahman is the non-dual self, right? The infinite self. So one recognizes that. And then he says, he recognizes that, not by any other way. There's no other means to know this. There's no other means to go there, is what he says. He goes to the self. He reaches the self, and not by. There's no other means to reach that. Why? Because that's becoming really what do you call it? Tribal. Only my way. It's just, there's no other way. So only this way. Why? Because you already are that. You can't. There's not two ways to become what you already are. Since you already are that, there's no travel, there's no path, there's nothing to gain, there's nowhere to go. And so it's only a matter of knowledge, it's a matter of seeing it. There's no other way to get there except by seeing it. That's why that sampashan means recognizing clearly. One gains Brahman. Recognizing clearly, one gains Brahman. There is no other way. Because Advaita, non-duality, there is no second thing. You either recognize it or you don't. See what I mean? There's no where to go, there's nothing to achieve, there's nothing to do to have this path or that path. It's either you recognize it or you don't. What other choice is there? Any other choice is other than knowledge is going to involve duality, is going to involve doing. If we're talking about doing, then we're still stuck here within the creation. right? We're stuck here within duality. So you either recognize I'm the non-dual self, which is the truth of all of this, yeah, or you don't. It's very simple. And you could teach it in different languages. You can use different drishtantas. You know, all of that is fine. You can use all kinds of different teaching techniques and all of that type of thing. But in the end, you have to recognize I am the whole. You can't become the whole. You either are the whole or you aren't. If you are the whole, you can't become the whole. Right? Because there's nobody smaller to become it. You see that? So it's a matter of gaining knowledge. And so here now, in this next verse, he's going to talk about, in a sense, a meditation on this. And so he says, let's chant it, and then I have to explain a lot of things about it. Probably do some of it next week. Atmanam araniṁ kṛtvā, Atmanam araniṁ kṛtvā, pranavam chocharāraniṁ, pranavam chocharāraniṁ, jñāna-nir-matanābhyāsāt, jñāna-nir-matanābhyāsāt, pāśaṁ dahati panditaḥ, pāśaṁ dahati panditaḥ. He brings in, let me do this one, Atmanam Aranim Kritwa Pranavam Cha Uttara Aranim Jnana Nirmatana Abhyasat Pasham Dahati Panditaha. We're going to be talking now about a type of abhyasa, a type of meditation on Om. On the symbol Om. So let me tell you a couple of things about that first before we go into what he's saying here. The word for Om is pranava. With this kind of a, Om is a sacred syllable, so we have a name for it. The name is pranava. Pranava means that which is ever new, that which won't decline, won't become old. It's ever fresh, it's ever new. That's what pranava means. So now, so pranava is a name for Om. Om is a name for Brahman, okay, or Ishvara. It's a syllable, it's a single syllable, which is a name for Ishvara, name for Brahman. So now, let's look at, first of all, let's look at what does the word Om itself mean? Okay. Om comes from the root of Avati. Avati means Rakshati. Rakshati means it protects. That's what the meaning of Om. It protects. Comes from this verbal root, means he protects, it protects. So Om is that, the one that protects. It's Om. So the interesting is, Om, just for the little bit of Sanskrit, this word of, avati, the T drops off, that's a conjugational, third person singular conjugation, so we're left with of. And this root of takes a suffix called mun. It's a mun suffix in Pāṇini. So now we've got of plus mun. The un drops off, and so now you have of plus im. Okay. The iv takes what's called samprasarana, goes back to its simple vowel, and so then you have o, which is comprised of a, u, and the un drops off of the mun affix, and so you get a, u, m, which is om. Okay. So this is how om comes about, off of this root of. Okay. And so the word om itself means that which protects. It's made of these three syllables, syllables, a-u-m. Syllables means the a-u is o, and then m. So we get om, not three syllables. So it's the three letters, so om. Okay. Now, in the tradition, we have upasana and different types of jhanam, where we can meditate upon either a form is, we'll do a meditation on a form, it's called a pratimā, like, for instance, if I visualize the form of Rama, for instance, or I visualize the form of a deity, and I'll do a meditation on that deity. It's called that deity that we meditate on. It's called a pratima. I can also do a meditation on a sound or on a word. That's called a pratika. Pratima, pratika. Om, this om, is a sacred syllable. It's a sound. And so I can do a meditation on this pratika. It means it's a sound which I'm going to meditate upon. And so now, if I'm going to meditate on a sound or do an upasana on a sound, then that sound should have, as Swamiji will say, we have to load it with meaning. Right? The Mandukya Upanishad does this loading on this sound, om, on the sacred syllable, om. And once this syllable has been loaded with meaning, then we do a meditation on the syllable. Because when I load the syllable, the sacred syllable, om, with meaning, then what it does is it gives me, in just its own form, when I say om, I see the whole creation as Ishwara. I see the whole creation as a manifestation of Brahman. But I have to first load I have to load this letter om, the syllable om, with this meaning. So the Mandukya Upanishad does this for us. Where does this, what it says is this. First of all, if I'm going to have one sound that stands for everything in duality, one word that stands for and includes all words, one name that includes all names, that's kind of an interesting challenge. And so how they talk about it is like this. Is that just as being an actual sound or syllable that includes all possible names in it. They look at it like this. The letter you say that is the first sound that you can make. It's the first sound a baby makes. All you have to do is open your mouth. Right? And so of all sounds available, the very first sound that a person can make, pure sound, is The final sound, the last sound you can make, is im. Say im. I think Swamiji's taken us through this little exercise so many times. So you say and then im. Now, once you go im, you're done. You can't do anything else. Right? And u is in the middle. So just say it. So what they'll say is that this letter om, the makes o, because it's a diphthong, so you don't go au. When you have a diphthong, you have to say o. So you have, but it's made of Okay. So this letter, this one syllable includes all possible sounds. Because you start with the very beginning and you end with M. So between ah and M, everything else comes. And so the name Om includes in it all possible names. The name Om includes all possible names. That's one thing. Then within this name, they load the U, and M. The the Mandukya Upanishad, loads the with the whole manifest physical creation that we call Virat. So let the first one stand for the manifestation of the physical creation. Let the letter U stand for the subtle creation, what we call Hiranyagarbha, the sukshma, the subtle creation. It should be your mind, for Jiva, your mind or your dream state. This physical body would be, if from the standpoint of the jiva, this physical body would be The dream state or the mental state would be would be the deep sleep state, and everything is closed. So physical body, the mind, dream state. From the standpoint of the Samashti of Ishwara, is the Virat, the physical universe. U is the subtle universe, Hiranyagarbha. M is the creation in unmanifest condition. Because right? The creation is viewed as in the East, in India, and in the Vedas, the creation is viewed as something which is cyclical, something that comes into manifestation and goes in resolve, into manifestation and resolves. So how do I look at it is like this. When you say now, Om, what you're visualizing is the creation, whole creation, coming into into manifest condition. And when you close it, Om, it's resolved. Manifest, resolve. Manifest, resolve. Manifest, resolve. That's not all. So that's the And the whole Upanishad is on this, right? The Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishad, is 12 verses that goes into detail about this. The Now, not only that, when I say Om, 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 there's something else. And that is the silence from which the Om rises in sense. If I say Om, 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 there's a background of silence from which the Om rises and sets, rises and sets. That silence is Brahman. Right? It's called the fourth. Silence is Brahman. And so now, if I have been taught the meaning of Om, then when I say the word Om, when I bring that word to my mind, what I bring to mind is Ishwara. It's Brahman with Ishwara, because we're talking about the manifestation of the creation. And so as I go Om, 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 it isn't just the sound anymore. Right? It's the name for Ishwara. Where I'm looking at the cyclical, the manifestation and withdrawal of the creation, the manifestation, withdrawal of the creation, all taking place within a silent self. So the Om actually stands for, it is a name for Ishwara, and I've loaded it, it's been loaded in that, so that I actually can do, it's a pratika, means I can do an upasana on this sound, right? But now when I say the sound, I see the whole. I recognize it as a whole. And so here now, in this verse, what they're saying is, having made the Atmanam Adinim Kritwa, Atmanam here is just the buddhi. Having made my mind, here Atman means the buddhi, the mind. Having made my mind as the Adini, what they're looking at here is, in India, when you, for a ritual, you have to create fire. You have to make fire. And you make fire by taking what they call the lower arani, which is a block of wood. I think it's got a little hole in it. And they put in that block of wood like the upper arani, which I think is more like kind of a pedestal. And then they rotate it like that so it makes sparks, right? So that's called the upper arani. So what they say is, view your mind as the lower arani, and you put in it the pranava, the Om. You put in the Om, the upper arani, which is the pranava, which is the Om. And then it says, from the abhyasa, from the churning of this jnanam. Well, they use jnanam now is because it's not just Om. It's understanding what Om is. The jnanam, the knowledge of Om. This, because this Om holds the whole Vedanta is in Om, in this one syllable. You could start with this one syllable, Om, and unfold the whole Shastra in it. The next, so it goes like this, Om, then the Mahavakya, Chaturmasi, then all of your Upanishads. You can just, Om is enough. In the end, all you have to say is Om. That's it. But then that om has to be loaded with all of this teaching. Right? And so in this loaded om, view your mind as this, the lower adhani, and put the pedestal of om in it and churn it. And keep this churning it, you know, with this knowledge, with this jnanam, this understanding of om. Then what happens, he says, pasham dahati panditaha. The panditaha, the one who has this knowledge, who understands. Right? Because it's jnanam now. You have to understand the meaning of om. If you bring this to your mind, om, om, this is the churning, this is the abhyasa. Om, 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 om. Each time you see it, you have the whole vision. Om, om, om. By this abhyasa, by this repetition by Pandita, one who knows, what happens? Pasham dahati. He burns the bondage. He burns the... Pasham is rope. He burns the rope. The rope is the bandhana. The rope is the bondage. Because through this meditation of on om, seeing your make your mind the adhani, and churn this jnanam of om, and it'll burn away the bondage. Very interesting meditation. So, everybody see? Om, om, om. Okay. Okay. So. Let's stop there. I'm done. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Profound transmission. That, you know, I'm kind of trying to understand, how do you now do the loading? She said, we have to load it for everything. So it's
actually,
to kind of really give it the fuel to really kind of transform into something. Because it can just be mechanical practice. So, but my question is, could you point out where's the tire hitting the road now with this practice? You know, that's kind of what I'm trying to understand.
Couple of things. If I say the word cup, automatically in your mind, cup comes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to think about it. You say cup comes. Okay. So now what has to happen is that we can use om, this pranava, as a word that when you say it, this vision comes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so they're helping you by loading the word in a certain way, like for instance, two ways I said today. If you just take the it stands for all names. Mm-hmm. And so just that itself, that's a way of loading it. So when you say immediately the whole is going to come. It's a name for all names. All names are included in it. Right? So sometimes Swamiji will even talk about this manifest creation, manifest duality, as he'll say, you know, namni namani, means in a name there are names. Right? Everything breaks down into more names and more names and more names and more names. So now when you say om, if you think of the ah through the it's just a reminder that you why that word stands for all words. And so that brings that to mind. Then when you go to the and you think of as the, you load the with the whole manifest creation. Ooh with the subtle. With the object, the unmanifest condition. Right? And there's a certain logic to it, because when you say ah, your vocal cords are open, ah. That's a full blossomed ah. When you say ooh, there's some closure.
Mm-hmm.
When you say it's totally closed.
Mm-hmm.
The unmanifest condition. So the ah stands for the whole manifest creation, ooh for the subtle creation, for the avyakta.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it becomes a word for Ishwara. Then you recognize when you're repeating this mantra that it's rising and resolving into Brahman, into the silence. It becomes experientially full. You have to load it. If you don't load it, then, you know, it doesn't mean anything.
Mm.
But it becomes a name for all that is. And so now, as we go on teaching the reality of the Satsyam Nitya, the reality of the whole thing, that you're learning the the manifest, this creation, the subtle creation, the avyakta, the unmanifest creation, Brahman, Satyam, Mitya, all of that becomes associated with this word Om. Right? So that when you say it, it's filled with your knowledge. That's why they say this this jnanam nirmatana, you know, this churning of your knowledge, and your knowledge has been packed into Om. It could be packed into something else, but just traditionally, this is the most sacred syllable of the Vedas. Anytime you do say a chant, all beginnings, it always starts with Om. It's the most auspicious syllable. Another thing about Om, it's supposed to be, when you're chanting it, and Swamiji will tell jokes about this, in fact, you don't ever want to break up the diphthong. In fact, he says some sort of a papa to break up the diphthong. a diphthong, you know, O is a diphthong. It's made of two simple vowels, U. So you never say Om. You went somewhere once to some sadhu, or someone was chanting Om. He's always making fun of this because it's not right, it's not correct. He makes fun of it just to make sure it sticks in your mind. That you just say Om. You don't sing it either. You don't sing Om. You don't do that. It's just Om. It's a sacred sound. It's a syllable. It's a sacred syllable. So you say, you can go Om, 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 Om. That's fine. But not Om. then that's correct. But it's important to know these things, you know, because it's embarrassing. You're not doing correctly. So you have to do it correctly. But then say if you understand, like the Mandukya, we'll teach you Mandukya Upanishad sometime, but if you really load the word, you know. We load things all the time, you know, to give meaning to them. This one has to be loaded properly so it holds the whole. And it's very powerful. Except so other words like that too, like say if you were to say Brahman, the word Brahman can be like guga buga. But once Brahman is recognized, when you know what that means, when you say the word, then it resolves into the fact.
Mm-hmm.
You say Ishwara, the word resolves into the fact. So what if I've recognized that, what if the word Brahman has meaning? The word Brahman means Brahman. So you've recognized the meaning of this word. You have knowledge of this word. You have jnanam of the word Brahman. Then if you do a Mahabhakya, like Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, what you're doing when you say that Mahabhakya is you're resolving the Aham, the Ahankara. Aham means I. That's the name for the Ahankara, the I notion. You know, this Aham, instead of saying Dehoham, I am the body, you say I am Brahman. So you're making the Aham your I. What you mean by I, resolve it over and over again into Brahman. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's, sometimes we use a mantra like that, like Aham Brahmasmi, or I could say Shantoham. If the word, you know, Shanta means that which is complete peace, you know? If that word directs me toward the peace that is Brahman, then if I say Shantoham, Shantaha Aham, I am peace. You know, now I'm taking the Ahankara and resolving it into that, or Anandoham. Say I've recognized what it means when I say the self is Ananda. Say if I know what Ananda means, the Ananda of the self. So that word has meaning now. Now, this is all nididhyasana. This is what nididhyasana is. So now I say anandoham. Now the aham resolves into myself as on, which I've recognized as ananda. It's not a magic thing like where I say like a mantra, anandoham, 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 as though something will happen when you don't know what aham means and you don't know what ananda. Say, even if you said in English, I am bliss, I am bliss, I am bliss, I am bliss, and you don't have any idea what they mean by bliss in reference to Satchitananda, then it doesn't mean anything, because it's not a sacred syllable that is going to take me into some realms of experience. That's not what how we're using it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So in meditation, we use japa, so we do pranayama, do different forms of pranayama, and also japa to bring the mind in, with other techniques that we've even did before that, but japa would be something like Om Namah Shivaya. Om is just a sacred syllable that will precede the mantra. My salutations to Shiva, to Lord Shiva, Shiva who removes ignorance. So say I have some devotion to Shiva, then I can say Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. It's a repetition of the Lord's name in order to bring the mind into a state of break associative thinking and bring the mind into a state of quiet. But once I've brought the mind in, or I've done pranayama, for instance, or various things, I bring the mind into a state of quiet. Then I do nididhyasana, where I would bring in a different type of mantra, like Anandoham, I am Ananda. Asangaha, I am free of any type of attachment. Asangoham, where now I'm bringing in a mantra that directs the Ahankara to myself, to the truth of my being. So when I say, now say in Nididhyasana, if I say Om, 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 what am I doing? Is every time I say that Om, I'm bringing this knowledge in, because the entirety of the Upanishads, of the Vedanta, has been packed into this
But when you bring it to that knowledge, you don't start thinking. It's already been assimilated, right?
This right, like if you were to say cup, you would just get a vision of a cup, a vision of a cup, a vision of a cup. And you say om, because the om is packed with your knowledge. And when you say om, that's the vision that you get. So they're using it as a pratika, means it's a symbol that's been packed, you know, with a vision. So it's very powerful that way, you know.
I wonder about that term used for the...
What term?
The Hiranyagarbha.
Hiranyagarbha, yeah.
Which is, well, the subtle.
Well, if I say, how the Mandukya will, Mundaka Mandukya Upanishad will do it is, the name for this physical world that I perceive through my sense organs, you know, the whole, or as Ishwara, the Sameshti, the total, is Virat. So if I look at the subtle realm, like all the subtle, the five subtle elements that haven't gone through this process of Panchikarna, becoming fivefold, those subtle elements in total is what we call Hiranyagarbha. Right? So then the Maya in its unmanifest condition is what we call Ishwara. Means Brahman with Maya is Ishwara. When Ishwara manifests from the whole subtle, Ishwara is called Hiranyagarbha. If I call the looking at Ishwara from the physical, I call it Virat. It's all Ishwara. But I could say, just like I could say, there's this physical body, and there's the, and then I have my mind, you know. And there's the causal body that allows for the whole body-mind complex to project like that.
And the jiva is included both in the physical world and the subtle world as well, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah. The jiva actually takes on physical bodies in order to experience the physical world. Yeah. So now you have this physical body enables you to participate in this physical world. Where if you are in another loka, you know, based upon your karma, say you're experiencing another realm of reality, we call a loka, another world, then you'll take on a physical body, the jiva, you with the jiva, you this transmigrating entity, will take on a physical body that is true to that realm of reality.
And then where's the subtle world for the jiva?
It's the subtle body. The subtle body.
Would the subtle bodies be considered Hiranyagarbha?
Part of Hiranyagarbha. Because Hiranyagarbha is all of the subtle laws and all of the subtle elements also that haven't gone through this process of Panchikarana becoming fivefold.
Well,
remember the Panchikarana? Yeah.
There was like 19 aspects.
The subtle body has 19 aspects.
Yeah.
When the jiva doesn't manifest, then that's the subtle world, right?
When the jiva doesn't
have a body?
No, we say like the jiva is always taking a body because there's always going to be some world that the jiva is
associated.
He's always going to be taking some sort of a form.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it'll be using the subtle material to take a subtle form if it's in a subtle realm, but it'll always be, and it'll take the form using tamas. You know, the sattva, rajas, and tamas. So if it's in a subtle, on a subtle plane that hasn't gone through Panchikarana, it'll be taking a subtle form using the tamas aspect of the five elements. If it's taking a birth in a physical realm, then it'll be taking birth with a physical body that has gone through Panchikarana, that is true to whatever. It has to be true to the love, to the loka that you find yourself in. Like, look at when you dream, you may find yourself, this is subjective, but so in a subjective dream, you find yourself in that dream. Right? You've taken a form in that dream. Okay? That form that you've taken is through the tamas aspect of the subtle elements. Because it's not a physical realm. right? But you've taken a form. So what allows you to take a form is tamas. What allows you to move is rajas. What allows you to reflect consciousness is sattva. So if we want to talk within this, you know, maya, sattva, rajas, and tamas, then we can. So the subtle body, your subtle body goes on taking birth after birth after birth, going through subtle experiences.
I think what I'm trying to pinpoint is the jiva that has this huge account of karmas.
Yeah.
Where does that play into this picture?
It's that jiva that has this huge account of karmas has just taken this physical body.
Mm-hmm.
When this physical body dies, it'll take, based upon the karmas, it'll take another body, and another body, and another body. The karmas are kind of in the chitta, stored in the chitta. Just like you have so many memories, there's only certain memories that for you that are in operation right now. What if all of them came forward? You'd be really overwhelmed, right? You have many more memories than you're using at the moment, but they're there for you to recall. And so on a deeper level, there's many more, many, many more karmas and memories that are there in operation, but they're not manifest right now. They're not necessary right now.
So they're carried to wherever you are.
Yeah, they're part of the, they're carried along with the Sukshma Sharira. They're part of their avyakta, and not manifest. But right now, at this moment, do you have any idea how much is not manifest that makes you you,
mm-hmm.
in terms of jiva? I mean. So
it's impossible.
Yeah.
To have even a sense of that.
It's impossible to have even a sense of it, yeah. It's profoundly huge.
Mm.
So and in the next verse, is it possible that there will be surfboards and waves?
There could be. If that's what he wants. Possible. Like I'll say, what happens on your deathbed? You know, for a jnani, it's not a problem because everything's mitya. Anything can happen. It doesn't make any difference because it doesn't disturb the satyam. It doesn't disturb your being. You know, because your being is known. That's when you see everything as the atma. Not to see, it's just, it's not upasana. That you recognize the truth of that. But say for a jiva, when you're on your deathbed, what is... This is kind of as the tradition goes. What is most important to you? For your, what have you done with your life? Where, what is it? What do you really value? That's what will be there, and that's the, that sets the trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
You can't fake it. You can't not. You know what I mean? It is truly what has your life been about? What is meaningful to you? That sets the trajectory, and you can't on your deathbed try to think of something that isn't meaningful to you. What's meaningful is what the mind will cling to. That's how it is. It's not a matter of will at that point.
Is there any difference between jivatma, which is the individual self, and the paramatma, the universal self?
No. The jivatma, the Mahavakya of the Upanishad is that the jivatma is the paramatma.
So then why are there two concepts?
Well, because you take yourself to be a jiva. So another way of saying, breaking that, the atma of the jiva is the paramatma. The jiva thinks that what makes you a jiva is the ignorance that makes, that causes one to take the atma to be the jiva. Right? That's the ignorance. That's the beginning of ignorance.
Yeah.
And the recognition is that the jivatma, the atma which the jiva enjoys, that very atma is Brahman. That very atma is the paramatma, the atma of the whole creation. That's the whole Mahavakya. That's the vision of the Upanishad.
So related question, that is a different question. So basically that paramatma resides equally in everybody, right?
Yeah, it's the self of everybody.
So it resides same in the, say, a yogi who's meditating in the caves for 25 years, as well as a terrorist who's blowing up innocent people.
As well as an animal or a mosquito.
Right. So,
all beings.
This question comes, so what happens to that paramatma, that mind of the terrorist?
Well, remember that your mind is different than my mind is different than the animal's mind is different than the terrorist mind is different than, is part of Ishwara's mind, is part of it, not the whole mind. And so it's the, there's vast differences between minds, but there's one self that is the self of all minds. It's like, say if I ask you to have an imagination of a city with 1,000 people in it. You know, the small city, but say you have an imagination of the city street with 1,000 people. Right? That's one self that has this manifestation of the city with 1,000 people. In reality, all those 1,000 people enjoy the same one self. But each person within that imagination is different from the other one. And each could have different karmas. And some could have done terrible adharmas and have really bad karma. And some could be saintly, just so many different types of people. But the consciousness, the me, the sense of me, which each one enjoys, is oneself, is the Paramatma. But the karma, the Paramatma, doesn't transmigrate. It doesn't have karma. It never changes. Consciousness doesn't change. It's Advaita. It doesn't come and go. It doesn't change. It doesn't modify. It doesn't. It's not subject to punya and papa and all of these things. It's just the being, the me.
It's so never damaged and never dirty.
No. But it isn't interesting when you think of the worst. Say if you think of Hitler or a terrorist or the worst possible criminals, and know that when they think this, the me, the consciousness is me. It is me. But of course, the mind that's reflecting that is very different. Right? When it's involved in that adharma, there's just a lot of grossness and pain and darkness there.
Mm.
So that there's a dark mind, and then there's a, say, the mind of a saintly person. That saintly mind is really manifesting the kind of the purity and enjoying ananda and fullness and peace and all of these things, where this mind is much darker. But the me, the self, is the same self, illumining both. You know?
And what causes the darkness in that mind? Is it the karma? Or?
Karma. One's actions.
Mm-hmm.
That's why dharma is so important. Dharma is actually, in a sense, much more important than meditation or anything else, because without the dharma, you're just like putting a band-aid on. You stop meditating or controlling your mind, and it just goes back into the same darkness.
How does this?
That's brought about by the adharma.
How does this dharma protect you when it's so dark? The surroundings are so dark.
It protects you because it keeps the mind in a state of peace. There's a fullness in the mind, a wholeness in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
The dharma protects in that way, and also you're not accruing karmas, papas.
Yeah,
more suffering. Yeah. We all know, just through the assimilation of our experience, you know that you have to go toward dharma and away from adharma because of the mess it causes and the internal pain it causes. You keep learning that. You know, learning it and learning it and learning it, all kinds of subtle levels. And it just becomes, a dharma is just simply not worth it. And you keep learning it over and over again. You know. And dharma is so, the rewards are so staggeringly beautiful for dharma and so painful for a dharma, you know, that we finally succumb. After being beaten over the head. That's what my advice. I always like to think of the monkey with a hand in the jar, you know, the monkey that puts their hand in the big jar full of nuts and they can't get the hand out if they don't let go of the nuts.
And I like the definition of Om as being that which protects.
Yes, I do too. I like it. For Sanskrit people too, the etymology, how they build the word Om, you know, from these little suffixes and things, these Panini, these little pratyas in the Panini sutras, how Om is actually built. Mm-hmm. And it means that which protects you. It's really nice. Mm-hmm.
Also from India, I think they link the mantra for material gain, they drop the Om.
Oh, is that right?
And they add the Om if it's for spiritual, it's the same mantra.
I see.
What was that?
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah,
say if you have a mantra, if you say Om with a mantra, it's for antakarana shuddhi, for spiritual gain.
Mm-hmm.
Period. If you don't say Om, then it's for material gain.
Yeah.
But that's not everywhere.
The result.
Yeah.
Om.
Well, it's cold as a night.
Thank you.